Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Hotel News Now podcast. I'm Sean McCracken, news editor for Hotel News Now, here with STR's Jesper Palmqvist. Jesper, what's new and interesting across all of Asia Pacific this month?
Well, as we close the thanks for that. As we close the third month, the first quarter of the calendar year, in one way, it's more of the same. But we're also moving between. It's a lot of shoulder faces, so between peak and low seasons for a lot of markets. Obviously, when we're at macro level, we're still looking at some occupancy levels and demand levels for in tourism and in hotels still on the table. The rate that has been such a story for everyone, and the pressure and people spending more. That rate growth is still slowing down. It looks like Asia Pacific now, we're overall at about just north of 10% above 2019 levels. It's obviously a huge mix behind that, with some highs and lows, but that is, you know, starts coming down that growth pace, right? And the difference. Profit margins keeps improving, but at a slower pace. So I think we found reasonable balance in March as well, where people maintain their cost another month. And that was always a tricky month because in some of those, some of the key markets, March is a soft month, not too many events. And it's post, say, Taylor Swift things for some markets, right? So then you come in. And so it was important to see the profit margins hold up and productivity and cost. And we're working through, it's another month of a lot of release of new rooms, right? 24 is the last peak year of new supply across Asia Pacific. So that puts that pressure important on it. But if there was one key story that I've been hearing more about from countries, and that could be hotel associations, from governments, tourism boards, and hotel groups, is I wonder if something happened in terms of how they compare. Because countries would say, like, oh my God, the rate is too high, kind of popping back up again, and how it's just me, which is so not true.
Yeah.
Right? Because this is a global phenomenon in most countries that rates are higher than when you look 5 years ago, which makes sense. But
yeah,
so I think there's been more of that voice saying, like, oh, no, this is bad. And you need to do a sense check and drill down. What is it really? So yeah. I've heard more of that this month.
Is that concern that people are kind of pricing themselves out away from travelers?
I think there's two parts to that concern. One is from, say, other stakeholders, authorities, and maybe a bit of owners and that kind of stuff. Like, are we as a market and a destination being priced out? We are being non-competitive. And the other case is, of course, hotels saying, like, and operationally, can we push this high enough, et cetera. But in the first case, look at Japan. Low yen for a long time now. Super high rates. But it's easy then to go on the story, and we, CoStar, we've been on news in the last few weeks, and the story is high rates. Look at that over the, obviously, the big holidays being the sakura, the cherry blossoms that were, right? In some of those special places, hotels fully booked and crazy high rates. But so much of that is in the big three, Tokyo, Osaka, and Kyoto. So any American that goes to Japan is, of course, going to hit those three. It makes sense. Yeah. Now, the government wants you to visit 10 other cities, and maybe you do, but those are going to be the popular ones. The rate growth in the regional markets is much different, much lower and more sense, right? But I can see why it's scary. At a country level, rates are up by 20% versus last year, so not 2019. Yeah. I get it. I can look scared. Tokyo is 30% higher than last year in rates. That is international travelers coming up. It means domestic travelers with a weaker yen, they're going to struggle, for sure.
Yeah.
But you could argue market forces at play, right? And as long as people pay, we're good. And if you compare that to other countries, back to the previous point, let's not cry wolf just yet, I would say.
I mean, I'm not an expert on traveler psychology, but I mean, wouldn't it seem to... Hotel rates are not the only thing that would limit somebody from taking a trip to Japan, in my estimation, right? I mean,
it never was. And I think that's maybe what you need to rebrand this podcast to: travel psychology with Sean McCracken. Because I think you take it down and we do it myself. That's, well, maybe that's another thing. That's a new version of this. Japan, listen, first time I went to Japan was 30 years ago, and it always seen as an expensive country to go to. For most people, and you got to figure out the Shinkansen, the bullet train, everything expensive. People know, but they go there anyway because of all the other reasons. And now the hotel rates in those key cities are more expensive, so you budget for that. But the yen is weak, so it doesn't feel that much for European or American.
Yeah, for sure. So this is kind of completely off base from what we were just discussing, but I just wanted to ask you, since we spent so much time last month talking about India, and I spent last week in Europe at the IHF conference, where there's a lot of discussion about the impact of elections across Europe, across the US. Obviously, India's got a big election coming up. How big of a deal is that for hotels and hospitality?
Small. And if you look at any, my usual statement is like, hey, any geopolitical impact on travel and tourism and hotels, let's drill it down. So like on hotel performance has very small impact unless it really impacts, because then it really, really impacts. And that's still the case. So this year is, of course, election year galore around the world in so many places. India and Indonesia, we know from history that elections don't have a big impact on this. Now, what happens? Now, what is the impact? Well, the impact is it changes because in large, the largest democracies in the world, like India and Indonesia are, they you have more government business that goes to meeting space, goes to those key cities in provinces and regions where they're needed to do those meetings, etc. And that we know that, and we can forecast that in. It doesn't change the entire dynamics of a country. It doesn't. And we don't expect that either in our forecasting that we look at those particular countries where we're not going to do. And for me, that's the same thing as conflicts or war, right? So the Ukrainian, the war on, from Russia on Ukraine has been the same thing for over two years now. The impact here, we talked about that last month, is the flights, right? And how they need to fly longer. Middle East in conflict right now, we're not forecasting a huge impact on Asia Pacific markets for that.
I was going to ask you about that specifically in the airlift implications of European to Asia travel. It's not a big deal?
No, it's not a huge deal. And I mean, because when you look at it, from the airlift that we had, that we're still missing a gap, right? Middle East is an important hub for Asia Pacific to go back and forth for sure. Yeah. But you also have a lot of direct flights in there. And now the bigger impact was, of course, Dubai and the great floods in the desert that happened. That had an impact. So I think not yet. And if this continues to be de-escalated, which maybe seems to be the thing politically right now with other parties involved in that conflict, I think we should be fine. So we usually see less impact on hotels, but it's something that we obviously need to check and sense check around the market, but nothing yet. And listen, South China Sea, same thing. Philippines and the US are right now doing one of their big military trainings and activities, which China thinks is a bad idea. Doesn't have an impact on hotels at the moment either, right? So those things we track, and we're not seeing anything until it really does, right? Yeah. It's more, and that's why we can't compare that to natural disasters, right? Which has a direct impact straight away. The volcanoes that have erupted, obviously, in Indonesia, and some of the floodings that have happened in other markets, and in China, right? Great in Guangdong province, huge floodings that have a big impact on the Greater Bay Area, which is no bueno.
Yes, I would imagine. So you brought up something that is not a concern I've heard in the American hotel industry in a while now, which is digesting outside supply growth. I want to drill in on that, because honestly, it's kind of a novel concept for me now, because it's such a non-issue here now, and it feels like quaint and like old to think about, like supply being an issue. Like where is that, and how big of an issue is it actually?
Well, Sean, if you logged into the CoStar platform and looked at the office and retail sector, you would feel right at home and join our conversation, because that's the same thing happening in the US, right? So what we have now is we are like 23 and 24. and China even a little bit more delayed moving into 25, especially in some tier two cities, tier one and a half. There's still a lot of supply that was delayed, yeah. And the new organic. There are some countries and markets that will take that up and run with a slight bump in the road, but there's definitely markets where they're feeling it. And it's a continued, it's Australia, Melbourne, we talked about it a long time, that Sydney and Melbourne, that comparison, Sydney didn't have as much, Melbourne does, and therefore the performance in Melbourne is more muted generally than Sydney, because Melbourne is still eating up a lot of cool new brands and supply. Great for the future, but that's the thing. Singapore, that's one of the key reasons why we're 5% off the pace in business on the books for the next 6 months compared to last year. We're adding, you know, the Artisan, the whatever it was, like all these new hotels that have popped up, new Como, et cetera. So we still have it. And even in some countries where it's more transactional and rejuvenation, the same like Japan, in China, Indonesia, and Vietnam is maybe the biggest one, right? And we talked about that last time, how they're growing occupancy now, but there's still a lot of supply behind there, which why that is going to take a bit longer. But if you follow Vietnam as an example, obviously more in the news has been Trong Milan and the death penalty for the Bank of Saigon and the property tycoon there. They continue to clamp down on the issues that they've been having, systemic issues of corruption, and moving in that direction. And that obviously holds back things a little bit further.
Yeah, but it seems like a clampdown in any sort of like lending environment in China is a fundamentally different thing than what we'd see here, obviously. Yes. Like they can turn the tap back on at will, almost.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one difference on that conversation from last month is it continues to be, the concerns don't go away with the same, like with that argument than in China. So consumer spending is still a concern in China. And you can see it in the numbers. So people wait. It's a little bit of a dangerous game when you look at, okay, no, we got another public holiday coming up, right? Yeah. The big three golden weeks. And now we have the Labor Day coming up. It will do well. Probably lift Hong Kong as well. Another market will be good. But can't get away from the fact that tier one cities, most predominantly Shenzhen and the Greater Bay Area there, they're dragging the country down right now still. Mm-hmm. Supply, rate pressure, et cetera. They didn't catch that big rate train, right? Yeah. But year to date, in that first quarter, occupancy is slightly down year over year. March, 4% down. Rate didn't really grow in March. And the only other place that I can think of in Asia Pacific where rates didn't grow in March compared to last year is Myanmar. Yeah. So you don't want to be on that. Yeah,
so that's not the country you want to get compared to in terms of business.
No, not at the moment, I'm afraid. So I would, you know, people that sometimes are like, hey, China, it'll be fine. After the two sessions, well, a couple of months ago, we're still waiting on how that new plan will evolve and stimulate the economy, which will primarily support the spend for domestic tourism and retail and everything else. Office is still very much away from the landlords. It's the tenants market, similar to the US, well, for different reasons, right? So similar. So, there's still pressure on it throughout this quarter, I would say, until we start to see any GDP insinuations of turnaround.
Yeah.
It's a big ship.
Yes, it is. It is, which is, I mean, living in a country that has a massive economy, I know it's not so easy to right the ship midstream. Yeah.
No, I was bringing up to our Chinese team the what do they call it now? Near sourcing. How the Chinese companies are putting up big shops in Mexico close to the border.
Yes, you know, that's a huge. Everyone I speak to in Mexico, and I go down to Mexico at least once a year. That's such a huge deal for them. Like, all they want to talk about is nearshoring and how big of a deal it is. Because obviously they're a big manufacturing hub, but this is like exponential growth for what they're trying to.
Oh, like hiring 300 people, hiring 1,200 people, hiring 2,500 people. Mexico's put in the sign up saying, welcome China, right? Yeah. But what's different with this from traditional Belt and Road initiatives is that with that distance and also how it's set up. My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that in these factories, the factories are funded by Chinese money and set up and via Chinese leadership, but I believe Mexican workers primarily. Is that true?
Yes, yes, for sure.
So that's a big difference, right? Because when you come in and building ports in Hambantota, Sri Lanka, or Eastern Africa and for digging or whatever it is around the world on Belt and Road, it's usually Chinese workers as well, which drops down into that. How do you, in the receiving country, small and medium enterprises across manufacturing, etc., compete with Chinese? But here, it seems a different synergy, no?
Yes, for sure.
So is that an American worry?
I've no one in America is talking about it.
Like, ooh, literally. Well, they are now, thanks to this podcast. Sean is shining travel psychology podcast. He's shining a light on what does this mean for the U.S. when you got the combined forces of affordable labor for the Chinese and nearshoring the skill set and the capacity and the speed that they bring in manufacturing on the other side of the border. What does that mean for someone in Texas who's...
I mean, I will tell you the perspective in the U.S. on this largely has been positive. The little bits that comes up, it's basically securing the supply chain type of thing. I don't think that the breadth of American manufacturing is such now that manufacturing's been moving south of the border in this country for a very long time. I don't think that that's a new concern, is what I'm trying to say.
Fair enough. Interesting. Well, good to get that perspective. We moved from Vietnam, Myanmar to Mexico in a jiff, which is good.
Well, this is a little bit closer to where I'm at, so maybe I can play the role of something other than the dumb American. I can play the marginally informed American for a minute. You brought up the impacts of the kind of weakened yen. That begs the question, is currency playing a factor in other Asian countries? Is it a big deal anywhere else?
That's a good question. Yen is a huge difference from the others. Now, on how your currency is, I was going to say pegged, but that's obviously the wrong word, but how they were relating to the US dollars. A lot of them look at the Singapore dollar, right, which has this band within which it's moved. So it keeps really closely to it. So the Sing dollar is strong. The Thai baht has definitely taken a little bit of a hit, but that impacts more on an export-import basis for their car manufacturing, that kind of stuff. And also the movements have not been as strong for the various dollars, the Aussie, the Kiwi, et cetera. And the other markets, and the rupiahs and for the big countries, rupees and rupiahs, India and Indonesia, the movements have not been big enough. And since they are so big domestically, it has less of an impact, right? And again, inbound tourism is not a big deal for some of those countries, for China, India, and Indonesia, right? So then I'd say no, Japan, the short answer is probably no. It's in Japan there for that. It's interesting, when the only country we don't talk about too often, Korea. When I hear about Korea more, it's their outbound power, right? Koreans, well-traveled, good spenders, good, the receipts per traveler, whatever they factor in there. They, a lot of destinations and hotels are like, oh yeah, and I'm back up to my levels here of Koreans and even beyond, et cetera. And people like it. That has a national cap. It's, it's not China. But it's important.
It's a much smaller country for sure.
But percentage wise, they contribute really well to a lot of countries, and it's an important outbound market for many.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. So, first quarter data in the books, most of the way through April. How are you feeling about 2024? Has your outlook changed at all?
Has my outlook changed based on that? No. Broadly speaking, no. There's a couple of markets where I would have expected rates to fall a little, not fall, but the growth pace to slow down a bit, say like Bangkok, that we go like, okay, March, April was a bit softer. But on a full year perspective, it ended the quarter kind of as we expected. We know we come into that second quarter where many markets will not have, obviously in the southern hemisphere coming into winter, where It'll have a different seasonality. It'll be interesting to see the maybe one of the first years since the pandemic where we'll expect some really strong numbers there. But no, I still feel our forecast there where we say occupancy levels should be around in and around the 2019 levels. Some will be behind, and that is Bangkok, a little bit in Singapore, but overall be the front there, and that high single digit or something rate growth since 2019.
Anything we forgot to talk about, Jesper?
The Indianapolis cult. No, we. No, I think that's good, because this is one of those where I would have kind of expected a little bit more change from March, but fortunately, I stick to my guns that vanilla is good. When boring is good, vanilla is good. Forecast a little bit easier. And as we're not far away from the budget conversations, so 25 are kicking off, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, well, in India, of course, the fiscal year ended with this March, and that was a phenomenal year in India. So now they kick off and see how much will that growth in this new fiscal year and an election year. But I think so far so good is kind of the headline on what we forecasted.
Yep. Just knock on wood, nothing crazy happens.
Correct. Yeah, let's see how April that pans out. But I tell you what, April also so far, pacing the way as intended, which increases the concern for some for occupancy and not comparing. Is it just me with a higher rate? So that's a lot of conversations around that.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time, Jesper.
Hey, thank you, Sean. Good to see you again.
Hi, I'm Isaac Colazzo, Vice President of Analytics at STR.
Hi, and I'm Jan Fajtak, National Director for Hospitality Analytics for the CoStar Group. Tune in to our new show, Tell Me More, a Hospitality Data Podcast.
It's a podcast on the global hotel industry, its current trends, what we're thinking about, and where the industry's going.
And we like to have fun with the data, too. Find us on hotelnewsnow.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe today.
This episode of the Hotel News Now podcast was recorded on April 22nd, 2024 by Sean McCracken and edited by Rachel Dobb. Look for this and more podcasts at hotelnewsnow.com.